I must confess that I never dreamed that I would come back to Illinois, having left for California when I retired, that I would come back by way of New England, because we did feel after 20 years of administrative work that the time had come for a more leisurely tempo. I wanted to go back to my first love, which was writing. I wanted an opportunity to think again. And that's why we took a little place in Sherman Oaks, which is a suburb of Los Angeles. And then I discovered that I was the president of the university and I had to stop thinking. And a good deal of the scholarship that I hoped to go back to really went down the drain. I recall the fate of David Starr Jordan, who was probably our greatest ichthyologist, and he knew more about fish than any man alive. And then he became the president of Leland Stanford. And then after a year, he said wistfully to one of his trustees, "Now every time I learn the name of a new benefactor, I forget the name of an old fish." But there have been many compensations, and I've thoroughly enjoyed them. Pioneering a brand new university has special challenges of its own. We're starting from scratch. We've inherited a great campus of 100 acres and many millions of dollars worth of buildings, which were given to us. It was a good start for a university. But everything was built from bottom up, with just a freshman class last year. And then this year, a double-size freshman class, so that we have just freshmen and sophomores. And next year, we'll have three classes and then four classes. And building in that way does give a special thrill. Of course, we're constantly oppressed by the sense of tradition in that tradition-laden community, with Harvard right across the river, and Boston College, and Boston University, and Wellesley, and Radcliffe, and the rest of them. We find ourselves constantly confronted with 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, and even the baby, MIT, which is 50 years old, seems to me, of course, a very hoary institution. In the Middle West, you're not oppressed by that sense of tradition at all. I remember when I went to the first convocation, Look magazine had sent out a number of photographers to write up a story, and I turned to the head photographer, who apparently was a Harvard man, and I said, "Why don't you come with me? I think this is your story. You've been shooting pictures of professors and buildings. This is the first convocation of the first year of the first institution of its kind." I said, "Just think if you could have had a picture now of the first class at Harvard." And he looked at me and he said, "There was no first class at Harvard. Harvard always was." I wondered how long an institution had to be in being before it could develop that sublime arrogance. Well, it's really a delight to come back. And I want to speak only for a little while. We must have some time for questions. Upon a theme which I think is very close to our hearts. I don't think it takes any special prescience to realize the dilemma in which we live. On the one hand, the finest and highest physical standard of living of any people in all history, and on the other hand, a deep sense of unquiet, of anxiety, of insecurity. On the one hand, power and strength such as no nation in history has ever attained, and on the other hand, a real fear as to whether we really have security. And this dilemma has catapulted us into doing many, many things. We're spending tens of billions of dollars to keep building our military fabric. We're spending many billions of dollars to anchor alliances in European countries. We're obliged to ask for the credentials of even of our most esteemed leaders to make perfectly certain that they don't bear within them alien ideologies. We want to know where they stand, and it sometimes brings us to inquisitions. But I think the most serious development of all, which has come out of this dilemma, is a growing lack of confidence in our capacity to cope with our problems. I think that's the chief characteristic of our time, a growing lack of confidence in our capacity as men and women to cope with these problems that we have to face. We seem to have moved into a climate of inevitability. We hear men speak of the inevitability of war. No matter what you do, no matter what acumen and resourcefulness you apply, it's bound to come. You may postpone it for 6 months, you may postpone it for a year or for 2 years, but life has now become so complicated. The iron curtain that's fallen between us and those who were former allies is now so opaque and so impenetrable that we must expect that war is inevitable. Depression is inevitable. How often do you hear that where you turn? At the moment, we're in a high point in the stock market, and it doesn't look as if there are Cassandras that have their feet on the ground. And yet even the best businessmen in every part of the country keep talking about the need for preparing for what must be inevitable in our system, because boom must be followed by bust. Friction is inevitable. I took part, as many of you did, during the month of February, in many so-called brotherhood rallies, where the Catholic priest and the Protestant minister and the rabbi stood on a platform together, and they spoke of the need for brotherhood. And there was an uneasy tugging at the heart on the part of so many in the audiences. But these were just glib generalizations, because man is by nature predatory, and human nature can't be changed. And there's an inevitability about social friction. And so we're in one of those historic moods which we've had so often in human history, in the great letdown period, where we've been completely taken hold of by the dogma of inevitability. And many of us feel that these economic and social and political forces, impersonal forces, are now so powerful that human beings are just cockle shells. We're not really the masters of our destiny. We cannot really control our future. We're in the hands of an inexorable fate which is drawing us in the direction of doom. I can understand that sort of mood in Europe. I can understand it in a country like Germany, which has been torn apart by the misdeeds of its misleaders of the past generation. A country divided between the French and the Russians and the English and the Americans. What is a youngster in Germany who's 18 years old today, or 19 or 20, what is he to think about the future? What has he got to look forward to? How can he plan a career? How can he speak with optimism? It's perfectly understandable if he swoons into defeatism and cynicism and becomes completely nihilistic and divests himself of all ideals of service and believes in living only for the moment. I can understand it in a country like France, teetering on the edge of the abyss, about to fall over either into fascism or into communism, the third force having been almost completely rubbed out. I can understand it in Italy. I can understand it even in England, living on an austerity plane which seems incomprehensible to us. I can understand a highfalutin term like existentialism coming to us from European countries because they've gone through so much. But here in buoyant, pragmatic America, which has always had so much confidence in the ability of a man to conquer a desert, to conquer a forest, to conquer even natural hazards, certainly to conquer problems that are man-made, to sit on the mourner's bench and to wring hands and to cry out that the time is out of joint and that we're in a period where no matter what we do, we're the victims of circumstance. That's a strange turn of the wheel, this whole dogma of inevitability, because a half a century ago, it was with us too. But it was not the inevitability of doom, it was the inevitability of progress. My old professor at Cambridge, under whom I wrote my doctor's thesis, did a superb book which he called The Idea of Progress. And in it he pointed out, because of the perfectibility of man, because man was by nature good, progress is bound to come. Year by year we can see our gains, and if only enough light were let in, if only we exposed young people sufficiently to education and to educational techniques, we could count upon the ultimate elimination of poverty and disease and all of the difficulties that ail our society. There was an inevitability of progress, and now it's the inevitability of doom. This is not just an academic matter. It isn't something that we discuss in a philosophy classroom. Because if that's the prevailing climate of too many people in this country, it inevitably affects our ethics. It must influence our action. It propels a great many people into cynicism. They begin to wonder of what use it is to devote oneself to service. Because if you eat and you drink and you sleep and you sweat and you procreate and you die and you go down into the ditch, man and horse together, if life is just vanity, vanity, all vanity, just a brilliant interlude between two nothings, the nothing that was and the nothing that will be, and that you're mastered completely by a fate that you cannot control, then you're a sucker. If you give yourself to service, you begin to use the term idealist as a term of opprobrium. And in our society, woe be to any so-called statesman who enunciates principles that are likely to be interpreted as idealistic. Because the worst thing that you can say about a man who wants to be considered a practical statesman is that he's an idealist. Or you move over into the field of escapism. T.S. Eliot summarized that when he said, "We seek distraction to distract from distraction. An endless routine of futility." Marquand, with brilliant clinical skill, pointed that out in a typical suburban society when he wrote, "Point of No Return." Told the story of a society like yours or like mine, where the men and the women lived only for the purpose of satisfying the most superficial needs, not dominated by any great passion, not devoted to any great cause, not impelled by any real ideal of service, but simply living for momentary gratification. Wasn't even existentialism, it was instantism. Right in that moment, in the niche that you have. And so you went from your social engagement to your club to the choice of the school with never anything in mind except to meet the moment. You didn't even entertain because you got pleasure from entertainment. There was a sterility about your entertainment We must have them over tonight, not because we'll enjoy their society, but we owe it to them. You think of obligations, social obligations, in terms of what you owe. They had us, therefore we must have them. Until the hero in the last part of the book wakes up and asks himself, where am I going?